Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Telerik. Create compelling app experiences across any screen with the Telerik platform. Telerik's end-to-end platform uniquely combines industry-leading UI tools with cloud services to simplify the entire app development cycle. Telerik offers everything .NET developers need to build quality apps faster. Try it free at telerik.com/platform. That's telerik.com/platform.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 423. In this episode, Scott talks with student and video game designer Lauren Scott.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm talking with Lauren Scott. She's a game designer and a student at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and also has spoken at the Game Developers Conference recently here in San Francisco. Thanks for chatting with me.
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
So your major is in computer science, or can you major in game design?
Well, at UC Santa Cruz, there is a computer science game design major, and it focuses a lot on coding with a lot of other classes geared toward giving you that kind of holistic design education, be it in ethics or art or just general design classes. But I opted for the computer science degree because I also wanted to study economics, which is actually what my second major is in, and so I wanted to kind of put those two together, but I've been doing a lot of game design research, so that's kind of where I get my design fix in at the school.
Mm-hmm. And when you are in school and combining two things like that at the same time, are you planning to do like a SimCity type things and economics games, or is it just literally you're interested in two things at the same time?
My view going in was that I wanted to make sure I was really, really interested in coding and, computer science, but I felt like if I only majored in one thing, it might be too limiting for me. I wanted to have another major to round out my education to give me kind of, I felt like coding was kind of like a very specialized, thing, but economics can apply to a broad set of things. I guess you can say the same for coding. My philosophy is if there are two things that are going to stay constant in our society, it's technology and business. So I wanted to cover both bases. And I figure they were the two most useful things that would help my career and my goals and help me do what I wanted to do.
Yeah, it does seem to be a challenge. You want to pick something that's going to be utilitarian and useful, but at the same time, you have a dream and a plan, and you want to make sure that your skills and your degrees back that up at the same time.
Yeah, and I definitely feel like both do. I'm very, very interested in both, and I feel like both will aid me greatly in achieving my goals.
Do you think that modern game design is very multifaceted? I mean, something like Mario seems on its face to be fairly simplistic, but you know, modern games, I think of things like Mass Effect or Modern Civilization and Age of Empires are really, really deep and complicated.
Yeah, actually during my talk at the Game Developers Conference, I was talking about how I feel like game designers and developers are the Renaissance people of today, because in the past Renaissance men had to take you know, the current technology, science and physics and math, but also all of the art, philosophy and literature, and blend it all into one kind of expression of humanity. And I feel like that's kind of what game designers do. You can't create a game without, like, a really, really polished high-end game without an advanced physics system and realistic looking art and an amazing musical score and, you know, complex narrative, and all these things like go into games. So even something as, you know, seemingly simplistic as Mario or, you know, any game that may seem simple, it actually, there are huge teams or small teams, but teams that encompass all those different aspects. So
Yeah, I think I probably inadvertently insulted Mario lovers there. I didn't mean to imply that it was simplistic, but just kind of comparatively simplistic over something like that's so sweeping. Like if I think of like an Assassin's Creed, where you just look at it and you think, this is so much more complicated than a two-hour movie.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's a pretty good justification for, you know, paying the $60 because you get, you know, I know someone who got over 100 hours of gameplay out of Assassin's Creed, and it's because they pour in all of those resources and that knowledge. You know, Assassin's Creed even delves into, like, the history and, you know, making its best effort to be as accurate as possible and weaving that narrative and, you know, just putting all different types of things into the game that in the past weren't even thought about, you mm-hmm. know, to incorporate into a game.
What was that quote that Roger Ebert said about how a game, video games, would never be art?
Yeah, I don't know the exact quote, but I've definitely heard about that. And I definitely think games have met and transcended those, the requirements that he may have had for that. I mean, just play, like you said, like an Assassin's Creed, or, you know, even some of the mobile games that are coming out right now, like this game called Monument Valley takes Escher's paintings and turns them on their head to make these really crazy, like, puzzles, but the entire thing is just very performative and very polished and beautiful, and, you know, it's games have definitely come very, very far. I would definitely consider them an art form.
You mentioned team size kind of indirectly there, as you talked about, well, there's small indie games that are one or two person teams, and then I've seen, you know, teams of 60, 100 or more, the sizes of a small movie.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about, you know, the team size as it relates to what makes a game an indie game versus, you know, some of the larger productions where you say, well, you can't make a game without a $2 million or $5 million or $10 million budget?
Well, as someone who, you know, is still in school and hasn't done either the big budget or the indie yet, but has kind of, I've been exposed to both tangentially, I would say that, well, for one, I think that the smaller the team size, if a team of a very, very few people can produce a game that rivals a team of like, you know, hundreds, and like at the the Game Developers Choice Awards at GDC, there was a game that I believe only one person made, and it was up against like a Rockstar game or something, like, and, you know, if someone can create a game of that caliber with such a small team, I think that's, you know, that's very, very impressive. But because of that, I think indie is a bit of a buzzword right now. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have this very, very romanticized vision of what indie is and what an indie studio does, because we see those very, very visible and, you know, very visible indie developers, like in the movie, the indie game movie, with those few developers, or at the Independent Games Festival, we see them up in lights like that. It's like there are, at least from, you know, being in a school that puts game developers out into the world, there are droves of us that, like, droves of, like, game design students who have that dream of being indie. But I would guess that to qualify as being indie, I was actually recently at a conference that one of the speakers argued that the aesthetic of a game can heavily, like, contribute to, like, there's, like, an indie aesthetic, like, an indie mm-hmm. style, visual style, and he was saying something, I think it was Jesper Juul, he was saying that a lot of indie games, the materials that they make their games look like they are made out of are like paper or things that you make like lovingly and maybe it's slightly cheaper materials, so that it kind of conveys this kind of like craftsmanship quality, almost like I made this game lovingly for you. So the art style and aesthetic definitely contributes to that. And the smaller team size, and probably a big one would be not being funded or supported in any way by a big developer like Sony or, you know, a big publisher. That's probably a big part. But I think and you can see that I've gone off on a lot of different, you know, points here, but I think the reason for that is because the name, the word indie is so amorphous right now. It's so kind of fluid, and a lot of people adopt it, and it's kind of become, it's become something that the industry is still, like, a lot of people are using it to define themselves, but the word itself maybe isn't completely defined.
Yeah, I mean, I think indie is one of those things where you know it when you see it. But I think that you're right. There's a texture.
Yes.
There's a texture, both, no pun intended, in the textures themselves. But also, I think in the gameplay, it mm-hmm. seems to me like indie is, something that's not afraid to break gameplay rules. Like when things like small games like Braid came out that were just too funky to be mainstream and too, they didn't fit into any kind of, box. So no one would pay, you know, no one would, no big agency or no big publisher would put money behind something so crazy.
Yeah, and a big reason for that is because from what I have gleaned so far, once you have a proven concept, it's very, I mean, when you're putting millions and millions of dollars into a game, pouring like so much money into a game, it's kind of hard to strike out on a new IP or a new idea, especially if it's a risk. And indie developers, or, you know, smaller teams, are better equipped to kind of take on those risks and try for things that might cause them to fail, because it's not as catastrophic of a, like, it would be three people losing a job versus, you know, hundreds, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Which is funny, though, because even large game publishers are going out of business right now.
Yeah. I'm definitely not too sure why, like, the reasons for that. I mean, you know, a year ago I did a presentation on the economics of the games industry, and I never really uncovered the reason or the reasons behind all these huge studios kind of going under. I mean, one reason could be because the game is kind of interesting in that a lot of the money comes after the product is put out. And I guess that's kind of the same as with, you know, movies and film. But I guess I'm not sure how much films cost to make, but games, definitely, you're employing a lot of very, very highly skilled coders and 3D artists and everything, and, you know, pouring so much money into the labor and into the creation of, you know, if you're creating hardware or things like that. And so it's kind of, a lot of it is very heavily based on the sales of the software, and the money comes after you make it.
Yeah.
Unless, you know, there's a publishing deal or things like that, but yeah.
Well, and in this last few years, we've seen not just interesting gameplay mechanics and new styles of games, but also new economics, like the Walking Dead series of games, which have an indie feel, and certainly their publisher is more than an indie publisher now. But the idea of episodic gameplay, that you know, we don't know if this is going to go well, but we'll do season one, and if it turns out to be a hit, then we can pay another $5 for season two.
Yeah, there are definitely tons and tons of new, you know, strategies for monetizing in games, from episodic like Telltale to the microtransactions, like a lot of mobile games, and even, you know, consoles are making use of the online marketplaces for things like that, like DLC and things like that. But I think it's all just a different way to try to get at, what is the way I can maximize, you know, the money I can make by giving players as much value as possible, like, and kind of how do I get at that sweet spot with players feeling like they're getting the absolute highest? I mean, as far as the episodic structure goes, I think it's actually pretty smart, because you don't know how many episodes Telltale had planned. You know, they could have easily just had two or three planned at first, and then when they saw how successful it was, they could make more and more, but they didn't have to pour, like, instead of making a game that was three episodes long, And then if the first episode didn't do super well, well, they'd still poured all that money into a three episode long game. They only had to pour money into one episode first. And then if that went well, they could pour more money in. So that's a pretty good strategy. And I've seen, you know, interesting, monetization strategies. And in fact, I'm playing League of Legends right now, and they do it really well. They've already extracted a good bit of money from me. I used to have a friend who played a game similar called Heroes of New Earth, and he would buy these skins for the characters. And I was like, that just makes your character look different. Why is this really helping you, like, have more fun with this game? And he insisted that it did, and I didn't understand until I started playing League of Legends and really getting attached to these, you know, champions. And, you know, there's some magic in there that they've definitely captured, because, you know, you could theoretically play this game totally for free if you wanted to. And I think that's the beauty of it. I think that's, you know, the value that's presented to the players is that, you know, they're giving me the entire play experience for free, and I can respect them for that, and my friends can play without having to pay for it. But, you know, if I like the game enough, which a lot of people do, then I will contribute money to this because I believe in it and I'm not being forced to. And so I definitely think they have a good system going on there.
Yeah, I think that sense of value is different for everyone, of course. I mean, I hear a lot of people complaining about, oh, I played Call of Duty Ghost and I got 8 hours of value or 8 hours of playtime. And even now I've noticed that the Xbox magazine, the official Xbox magazine, the Dead Tree version, has now added a box where they tell you how many hours of gameplay you'll get out of it. But I've played games that were, you know, quite short that gave me 3 or 4 hours. I forgot the name of that game where you're running in the sand on a PlayStation that everyone was talking about.
Journey.
Yeah. That was like, I don't know, an hour and a half, 2 hours, but it was extremely emotional and amazing experience, and I'd like to do it again. And I felt like I didn't measure that in terms of hours of value. It was just, it was moving.
Yeah. You can definitely tell, kind of, like, as players, we can tell which studios pour money into the mechanics, the tried and true, you know, the proven concepts, and then the ones that go out on the limb and try to deliver the best play experience. The reason why there may be fewer of those types of games than of the tried and true proven concept games is because it may take more failures to create a game like Journey to try to get that feel exactly right. I mean, I heard Robin Hunneke, the one of the designers behind that game, talk about it, how they put the aesthetics for, instead of starting with, you know, designing the mechanics and then hoping that the mechanics lead to the aesthetics that they wanted, they started with the aesthetics in mind as the main goal and worked backwards to creating the mechanics. And that probably took a lot of failure at first. And for big studios, failure, you know, repeated failure causes the studio to close. And with all the closures going around right now, like you just mentioned, you know, risk is not something that's really tolerated too much. So, you know, it's putting those types of games out there that, you know, that present that kind of value to players is very, very important, but unfortunately it's a bit rare. And I feel like that's where the indies are picking up a lot of the slack. They're seeing, if anything else, they're seeing, you know, a niche that's not being filled, and they're filling it.
Yeah, absolutely. Was there a particular low point in gaming in your mind recently? Was there a time when you were just like, there's just so many first-person shooters that this is just all crap?
Well, I don't know about first-person shooter. Well, I've never been like a huge FPS fan, but that's probably why I couldn't say much to that, because I...
Well, what was there a kind of game where you just found yourself in the kind of in your history, your own personal history of gaming, where you're like, we are at a low point as an industry. There's too much of game style X.
Man, I was thinking about this one earlier, and I...
You know, I found, like, I, for example, I felt
guess,
there...
well...
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say one low point in the industry, I'm not sure if it was developers really that contributed to it, but it was when the Flappy Bird game came out, and the guy basically had to take the game off of the store after a few days because the... I'm not sure if it was the players or developers or who, but people were just, you know, flaming him on Twitter so much, or something was, well, I think he was saying that his basic life, like, was being disrupted, so he needed to take it down. But what ensued after he said he had to take it down was just crazy. People, it seemed like people had this ownership of this game that he made, you know, that they were, you know, saying all this mean stuff to him that he was gonna, about taking it down. And it's like, wow, you know, it's crazy that something that someone made, you know, even if it's something that simple, that the internet and, you know, just people can so quickly appropriate it as their own thing and feel so very abashed or affronted when the creator of the thing wants to take it down. So,
yeah, that was definitely a low point. People were losing their damn minds, I tell you.
Yeah.
I actually, a funny side comment, I just saw Flappy 2048. Did you see this?
Oh, yeah, I saw that one too. I tried playing it, and it, I don't know if it's harder than Flappy Bird, but it's definitely mind-bending for sure.
And sometimes I think that games will jump on a mechanic. Of course, you know, 2048 is really just a clone of Threes. You know, it seemed like a couple of years ago, everyone was doing Bejeweled. There seems to be this movement en masse as an industry towards different kind of memes. I don't know what the term is. Mechanics, maybe? Recycling of mechanics?
Yeah, mechanics. I mean, I think that the trend, well, for one thing that's probably aiding this a lot, that you're seeing a lot of these copies where you didn't see them before, is because it's become so much easier to develop an app independently and release it yourself, you know, as, I mean, tools for creating games are becoming, you know, easier to use, and there are so many tutorials out on the internet about how to make games and deploy them. So now, since we have this huge app store, the iOS app store and the Android app store, what usually happens is that someone comes up with a nugget of brilliance like Bejeweled or Flappy Bird, and then a ton of people with this game creation software will, you know, create the same thing, trying to piggyback on the success of it. Because if you can make something funny enough that's, you know, tangentially related to Flappy Bird or something, like I've seen, you know, Flappy Bird with every kind of skin imaginable to try to play at different audiences. But, you know, if you can even get 100 downloads of that at 99 cents each, well, that's a free $100 just from copying someone's game. So, you know, taking credit from someone else, it's definitely bad, but that's probably where it's coming from. And I think we're seeing it more now than we have before, is because in the past, there were, I mean, you couldn't copy a Nintendo cartridge without considerable effort, you know, so.
When you're studying this stuff, when you're thinking about art and business and technology and science and sociology and combining them all together, as well as things like game theory, brain science, and mechanics, how much is analytics, where you're literally sitting down and you're saying, this algorithm doesn't work, versus, I don't know why this game isn't fun, but I just know it's not fun. I need to think of a new way to make it fun.
I think at the beginning, you have the idea, and then you start fleshing it out and creating the bare bones, you know, prototype that encompasses that core mechanic that you're trying to design around and develop around. And as soon as possible, that should be tested. So with, you know, players. So at the beginning, you know, a lot of it is analyzing the core, like, construction of the game and the development and the code and stuff. But then once you put it in the hands of a player, that's when you can really, really get to, is this fun or not? Because you can play it as much as you want to as the developer, and you may think it's the best thing in the world. Or what often happens is that you have been working on this thing for so long that you're so close to it that you can't see its pitfalls or its, you know, the things that make it shine. So what you definitely have to do is test early and test often, you know, with actual players that are within the audience that you're trying to reach.
It's funny. I noticed that there are a couple of games that you would think would be not really fun and not useful, but then they would change one small thing and then suddenly it blows up. And the one game I think of is Borderlands, which on its face was a pretty basic first person shooter. And then suddenly they decided to give it a different tone, a different kind of narrative tone. And then they added cell shading, and then Borderlands and Borderlands 2 became these huge hits. And I just can't seem to get my head around how and why they would do something like that and why it worked. That means that they're basically one decision away from this game being, in the discount bin.
Yeah. It may seem like, one decision, like, there could have been this one guy in the cubicle and he just had this one idea that changed the entire course of the game. But usually they have probably like an entire art team that's devoted to figuring out the artistic vision of this game. And as far as like, the mechanics, whole design teams and stuff. And then they rigorously test these, the ideas that they have, because if they just went with what they thought was right and then put out the game, they'd be designing and developing the game for themselves. So what they need to do is take all of these different facets of the game and give them to a player, and or do internal testing to see, if it's hitting the right note. And I'm sure as opposed to one decision that made it the way it was probably a lot of fine tuning that made that happen.
Yeah, I think that as an armchair gamer myself, and not someone who has built any games, it is probably easy to generalize like that. It certainly feels like it sometimes, where you just don't know why this game feels like that. And I really admire the intangibles that they're able to take, and like two games like Gears of War versus Halo that feel they're both first person shooters, but they're completely and utterly and totally different, or Braid and Fez, which you might look at, and some of those are really similar, and then once you get into them, they're a totally different kind of game because of, like you said, hard decisions by large groups of people.
Yeah, and on the flip side of that, I mean, Fez was created by Phil Fish, and maybe I forget if he had a small team or not. And then Jonathan Blow, those were kind of the two different masterminds, and even like. So the reason for their games being so different is probably, it was all them, basically. Their vision, their ideas, led to kind of the different aesthetics and the different, decisions that were made. So, whether it's a huge team or just one or two people, definitely, that vision is very important.
Do you spend any time looking at board games or studying board games? Because there's kind of a board game renaissance that's been going on the last few years, and I wonder if you look at those mechanics and think about them in the context of video games.
Yeah, I've definitely, since I've started studying game design, any chance that I've had to play a board game, I've definitely looked at the, analyzed the mechanics as best as I could, and I had the opportunity to go to an event called Board Game, or well, it was an event at the UC Santa Cruz Extension where a bunch of game designers that actually work in the industry now brought board games that they had designed and created themselves, and they brought them there actually to playtest them. So it's definitely, like you said, something that's still very alive and well and thriving. I haven't been able to play as many as I would like, but I have one in my head that I'm kind of working on right now. It's kind of just sitting on the back burner. It's still kind of developing, but they're definitely a very, very important part of game design. In fact, if you're thinking about getting into video game design, one of the best ways to start practicing is to make board games, because that forces you, really, really forces you to think about things like balance, think about things like, just really solid mechanics, and it also enables you to prototype very, very rapidly and often because it's not costly time-wise or materials-wise to redo pieces of a board game. Whereas if you code something, it could be hard to undo that.
That's a great point. I didn't even realize that prototyping a video game mechanic with paper and pencil and then coding it up.
Yeah, that's actually something that game designers and developers do a lot, especially at school. Almost every game design class I've taken, we've done paper prototyping first in order to get a good sense of what maybe the core mechanic is, and then we move on to the coding. Sometimes you may have an idea that you feel like it can only lend itself to digital. Most of the time, that's not true. And if you're really, really insistent about, oh, this can only be made digitally, you're probably missing something. You're probably not thinking your game in the most holistic way that you could be thinking about it.
That's a good point. Well, I hope that you get that game that's on the back burner running around in your head. I hope you get it out of there.
Thanks.
Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today. Lauren Scott, game designer at University of California, Santa Cruz.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.